fact is a truth universally acknowledged, that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
From Ngunnawal Country in Canberra and acknowledging other custodians, I'm Lexi Junawick filling in for Luke Sidim-Dundon. And today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Australian government receives the Pentagon's long-awaited review of the AUKUS Pact. You'll hear from the Minister for Defence Industry, Pat Conroy.
We're hitting all the major milestones, including the docking of USS Vermont in WA only last month, and things are going well.
Then, a regional Australian town prepares to host what just may be the world's most unique beauty contest.
It's not just blokes, there's women too, and there's people literally across the globe who want to be crowned greatest mullet of them all.
That's all coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. The Pentagon's highly anticipated review into the $368 billion AUKUS submarine pact is complete. And right now, the federal government is working through its contents. Defence Minister Richard Marles has declared Washington is, quote, fully supportive of the deal. All this comes after Australia announced earlier this week it would reorganise its defence bureaucracy to improve defence spending and speed up the delivery of projects. For more on this, host Sally Sara spoke with Minister for Defence Industry, Pat Conroy.
Is there anything you can say about this AUKUS review and its contents as yet?
I'm not at this stage. We're working through the contents right now, but I'd obviously refer your listeners to the very positive comments from President Trump that AUKUS is full steam ahead. We're hitting all the major milestones, including the docking of USS Vermont in WA only last month, and things are going well. But as for the contents of the review, that's a matter for the US government.
Is it expected that the review will be made public?
Oh, well, that's a question for the United States government. I can't answer on their behalf. As I said, the Deputy Prime Minister and I have copies of it, and we're working through it now in a steady, methodical fashion.
So is it expected that the review would be published before Defence Minister Richard Marles and Foreign Minister Penny Wong meet their counterparts in Washington next week? Have you had any sense of that from the US?
I'm not going to go into confidential discussions with the US about those things. Ultimately, all I can say to your listeners is questions of when it will be released is a matter for the US government.
You've announced a major overhaul of defence earlier this week. Have you spoken to the US administration about this and how it might affect the AUKUS pact?
In advance of the policy being announced, we obviously briefed important partner governments. I should stress that AUKUS Pillar 1, which is the delivery of the nuclear-powered submarines, is the responsibility of the Australian Submarine Agency, which is a separate agency to the Defence Delivery Agency that we announced on Monday. So they are getting on with the job of delivering submarines. The Defence Delivery Agency is a once-in-a-50-year reform aimed at improving delivery of defence projects from both a schedule and budget point of view. And it is incredibly significant. I note some of your commentators that you had on earlier in the week got basic facts wrong about what it is and what it isn't. But I can assure your listeners that it's a very significant reform that will improve delivery of major capability projects, because we're all about getting equipment into the hands of the ADF as soon as possible, as well as making sure we get the best bang for buck for taxpayers' dollars.
Minister, Australia will start manufacturing guided multiple launch rocket system missiles this month after the opening of a new factory at Port Wakefield in South Australia. How many jobs will this factory opening create?
The initial factory will create around 20 jobs at it and hundreds of jobs in the supply chain. This is a really exciting announcement. This is the first time that a factory outside the United States, and only the second factory in the world, that will be producing these really important missiles. And this is a key commitment we made during the election, that by the end of this year we would start making missiles in this country.
Who will will be the factory's main customers?
For the initial factory, it will be for the Australian Defence Force. So the initial factory will be capable of producing 300 GMLRS rounds a year, so 300 of these particular missiles. But then we have an intention of building a bigger factory that could produce up to 4,000 rounds. And that's not just to satisfy our needs, but also to potentially export to places like the United States and other allies and partners.
The Port Wakefield factory is only the second facility in the world to produce this rocket system outside Lockheed Martin's facility in Arkansas. What does this reflect strategically for the region?
Well, it reflects that we are facing very uncertain strategic circumstances. We're facing a significant arms build-up in the region, and we've had to respond appropriately, which is about transforming the Australian Army into one focused on littoral manoeuvre and long-range strike focus so that it can keep any potential adversary further away from Australia and hopefully deter conflict. So what we're doing here is about increasing our sovereignty and self-reliance, growing jobs in our economy, and then giving the ADF access to the most modern weapons possible.
Yesterday, Australia committed to providing $95 million in military assistance to Ukraine, including $43 million worth of ADF equipment. Retired M1A1 Abrams tanks are also being gifted to Ukraine. When will all of the 49 tanks eventually arrive?
Well, the vast majority have already arrived, and that's really important to assure your listeners. The vast majority have already arrived, and the last few are in transit.
Will the government gift its fleet of retiring Tiger helicopters to Ukraine?
The Deputy Prime Minister and I approached the Ukrainian government a few months back, asking them would they be interested in receiving the armed reconnaissance helicopters when they retire. And we recently received a confirmation that, yes, they would be interested in it. So we're going through the process now to make a final decision. But gifting to Ukraine is our top consideration, and I'm working closely with Defence to look at all those options.
Minister for Defence Industry, Pat Conroy there. I'm going to take you overseas to Sudan now, where the civil war is raging on. A power struggle between the military and the rapid support forces has left more than 40,000 people dead. Many areas have experienced famine, and the demands on aid organisations have never been greater. Meanwhile, medical experts have warned the wider region could be facing its worst cholera outbreak in 25 years. For more on this, Sally spoke with Miriam LaRussi, who's the Emergency Coordinator for Medecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, in Darfur.
Well, right now the situation is really worrying. It's really worrying, especially since the fall of El Fasher and the situation that we're seeing in Tawila, the closest city where the IDPs, the internal displaced people, are arriving. Basically, you can see a lack of everything. Access to water, access to shelter, access to food, access to the basics, really. They're coming from a place that has been under siege, El Fasher, for a year and a half. And they're arriving with very high level of malnutrition, more than anything. But on the top of that, with wounds that are linked to gunshot, they're testifying of killings inside of El Fasher or on the way out, sexual violence. They're telling us like the most horrible stories. So yes, what we're seeing there is really a catastrophe, I have to say.
What's the condition of the children that are coming through, Miriam?
Well, look, most of the children that we're seeing are suffering from malnutrition. That's a fact, which is at a level that you don't see much generally. It's like close, I would say mostly all of them being acute malnutrition or moderate malnutrition, but all of them. And it's a bit the same thing when it comes to pregnant women. The rate is usually quite low, but in this condition, many of the pregnant women do also suffer from malnutrition.
How much trauma have these people been through? You were talking about some of the incidents that they've witnessed. How traumatised are some of the civilians that you're seeing?
They're all traumatised. All. They're reporting nightmares, they're reporting fear, hearing whatever sound, even if Tawila, the way that they're arriving, where they're arriving is a bit more quiet, a bit more safe, at least for now. They've seen so much, they've been through so much, burying their people on the way out, seeing their familiars, I mean, their neighbors being killed in front of them. That, yeah, they are all traumatized. Men, women, children, all of them.
How difficult is it to distribute aid at the moment in some parts of Darfur?
The first thing is that to distribute aid is that you need aid. Now, this crisis is totally underfunded. So as Doctors Without Borders, we've been stretching our capacity again and again to increase the access to healthcare, but this would be less needed if the Sudanese had access to food.
Miriam, is the international community, are they paying enough attention to what is happening in Darfur right now?
Definitely not. Definitely not. I mean, we're talking about the biggest crisis in the world when you look at the figures. And no attention is being paid to what's happening here.
How urgent is it for more humanitarian aid to come into Sudan right now?
I mean, I would say to Sudan, but to Chad also, where we have like close to 900,000 refugees from Sudan inside of Chad. Now, I mean, Chad, I mean, only 22% of the necessary funds are there. So urgent, I mean, it was urgent already a year ago. It was urgent at the beginning of this war, and it's going to be more and more urgent because the needs now are really piling up. So it has to be right now.
Miriam LaRussi, Emergency Coordinator for Medecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, in Darfur. Artificial intelligence is a hot topic at the moment, and this week it was front of mind for the Australian government, which released its AI plan and weighed in on the latest economic growth figures, which show the expansion of data centres is driving private investment.
Well, the investment mix changes from quarter to quarter, but this is a trend now. Frankly, one of the most encouraging elements of this data was the way that this business investment grew very substantially, and technology and data infrastructure was a big part of the story. And that's a good thing, because data and digital and artificial intelligence is a game changer for our economy. It'll be a huge part of the more productive economy that we're building into the future. And so we welcome this investment.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers speaking with Sally on the program earlier this week. Well, watching this global trend closely is Gil Larea, who's the head of technology research at investment firm DA Davidson.
What's the big picture here? What does global investment currently look like for data centres?
We are in the midst of the great data centre build-out. We have already, as an economy, as a society, invested hundreds of billions of dollars into building data centers that offer us the ability to do AI compute, and we're not nearly done. We are likely to invest even more next year than we did this year.
How does Australia sit in this global investment picture right now?
The investment has mostly been in the United States, backward looking. But as we move forward, we expect there to be investment closer to where the customers are, which obviously includes Australia as being a very large economy that is geographically distant from most other geographies, and therefore will need the AI compute capacity to be on shore in order to provide the lowest delays and latency for consumers and companies that want to use AI tools. So we would expect the data center build out in Australia and other advanced economies to take a very big leap forward over the next couple of years.
Where's the money coming from? Who's investing?
There's the solid investors, the companies that have all the cash and the customers. Those primarily Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. They generate a tremendous amount of cash flow every year, and they're building out most of the data centers around the world. In addition, there's been some other companies and newer clouds, neo clouds, Bitcoin company conversions, and there's a lot of money being lent to those companies that are borrowing significant amounts of capital in order to build out more data centers.
How significant are the financial risks here, Gil?
The financial risks are mostly in that second category. I worry not about whether Amazon, Microsoft, and Google can afford to build data centers, even overbuild data centers at some point, because they will be able to use all that capacity. They have all the customers. The customers have committed to years in advance of consuming that AI compute capacity. The risk is in the second category. The recent startups that are borrowing money with a leap of faith that the customers will be there, or that the customers that are other startups will be able to consume that AI compute. There's companies like CoreWeave that are entirely debt financed. It's a startup that's entirely debt financed, cash losing company that is providing mostly AI compute to OpenAI, which is another startup that's very money losing. And that's all funded by debt. So that's the some of the risky behavior. There's a possibility that things won't end well. But overall, we do need a lot of data centers.
These tech companies and investors, how seriously are they taking their responsibility when it comes to renewable energy sources for these data centers, which we know are very energy and water hungry?
Longer term, we would expect many of these data centers to be powered with solar power and even at some point, small modular reactor nuclear power. However, in the short term, they're drawing a lot of electricity from the grid. Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and companies like that are actually fairly responsible stewards of electricity capacity. They really do try to be net neutral, net carbon neutral. But right now, as they race to get all this capacity out, they're using a lot of fossil fuels.
There has been some concern and criticism that these data centers, while they use a lot of energy, they don't create a large number of jobs. Is that criticism warranted in your view?
It might be. What we're headed towards, again, we're not quite there yet, but I think the most important thing for us to do as individuals in society right now is actually learn how to use these tools and stay on top of it. I think one of the most important phrases uttered over the last few years was by an economist named Richard Baldwin, who said, we're not going to be replaced by AI in our jobs. We're going to be replaced by people that use AI better than we do.
Gil Larea, head of technology research at investment firm DA Davidson, speaking with Sally there. Now, for a hair-raising story to bring some good vibes to your Friday. In the New South Wales Hunter region, dozens of shaggy-haired hopefuls will meet for the annual Mullet Fest Grand Final in Kurri tomorrow. Beginning in 2018, the event raises money for people diagnosed with brain cancer, as well as raising awareness and support for men's mental health. Sally spoke with the event's founder, Laura Johnson.
How did this all start, Laura?
Look, it started in the teeny tiny town of Kurri. We had lost a generational job provider back in 2017, and I had the local pub at the time, and we wanted to do something kind of to cheer people up, give them something to laugh at. I guess just lighten the load and draw people to town, you know, not your typical trivia night, something that would maybe create a tourism injection. And the idea was born that maybe blokes compared their mullets. And then we realised that it's not just blokes, there's women too. And there's people literally across the globe who want to be crowned greatest mullet of them all.
Now, this event is a lot of fun, but it's a serious business for regional communities trying to come up with some way not only to lift the locals but to get those tourism dollars in, whether it's the Elvis Festival or people celebrating the music of ABBA and other things. What's it meant for the local economy so far?
Absolutely. So, this weekend, for example, we're 8 years in And the grand final is going to be tomorrow in Kurri Kurri. There is not a single hotel room or accommodation in the town booked out. There are people who are coming to this event from across the globe. So as far as the tourism goal, I guess we can tick that box. There's people staying in motels as far as sort of the nearest town is about 17 kilometres away, and we've got at least half a dozen families who are staying that far away and travelling in for the day, which means that it's not just the venue that will be benefited. You know, there'll be cafes and service stations and obviously the accommodation and the supermarket and all that sort of stuff.
This event, as you're saying, has a big focus on mental health, particularly men's mental health. Why is that such an important issue in your community, Laura?
Look, it's such a huge issue at the moment. There is not a person, I don't believe, in Australia who hasn't had a moment of, self-doubt or comparison or a darker sort of day. And this is one of those events where if you didn't fit in really anywhere else, you come to Mullet Fest where, maybe you've been a little bit of a fringe dweller, and all of a sudden people are high-fiving you and saying, "Nice haircut, mate, can I buy you a beer?" Like, it's all about the camaraderie. It's all about breaking that stereotype from total and utter bogan back to the Aussie larrikin, and they are good people. We're hardworking Aussies who want to give to charity, want to have a bit of a laugh, and then, of course, enjoy that party in the back.
So this has become really big. You've run 16 heats in the run-up to this grand final, with more than 600 people taking part in contests all over Australia. At the beginning, Laura, could you have imagined the scale of where you are now in year eight?
There is no way. We went from sitting at our little, table of knowledge in our pub laughing that if nobody else came, my husband and my father-in-law could have an arm wrestle and we would just, have a few drinks and a laugh. Right up to, like you said, this year, I've literally travelled across Australia. We've been to Perth, we've been to Darwin, we've been to Alice Springs, we've been to Cairns, to Townsville, to Rockhampton, like literally to Melbourne. It's phenomenal to think that we're able to impact people's lives. And from all of those venues, all of those events across Australia, there is at least one of the finalists is coming to the grand final, to represent their region and represent their town. And like I said, it's not like we're playing for sheep stations. You're not winning a car at a heat level. You get a certificate and a cuddle from me. That's it. And the glory, I guess, of being able to say, I won it.
You're going to be surrounded by mullets this weekend in Kurri Kurri. Thanks so much for joining me this morning and giving us a bit of the backstory of Mullet Fest.
No worries at all. I can't wait to see what the weekend has in store for us. And I open an invitation. We've extended wildcard entries till 5 o'clock today. So if you're sitting at home, you think, I could do that. Come on down.
Laura Johnson, the founder of Mullet Fest, speaking with Sally there. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the Radio National Breakfast Team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening.